The book, Farming the Lord's Land, is one that I organized and wrote two chapters for and got eight. Secretary of Agriculture, who did a foreword, got other writers to contribute too. It was published this spring by Augsburg and has, with each chapter, a guide for group use so that it could be used in group settings, in parishes or elsewhere. I stole from the bookstore three copies, Mary, which have to go back there. The one in the library was checked out by somebody. So I'm going to use one, and the other two I'll pass around, and you can page through it, one on each side of the room. But keep fingerprints off of it if you can, because we may want to sell it. The book's thesis is that farmers are co-creators with God in a special sense. We're all co-creators with God, but farmers in a special way, as producers of food, not only producers of food, but stewards of the earth in a special way. In fact, I first heard the word stewardship in Iowa farm country, referring not to contributions for the mission of the church, which is the way we've often narrowed that word down, but to the care of the earth by farmers. And the book has as a presupposition that the growing of food, the production of food by food producers, must always be conscious not only of this year's harvest, but next generation's use of the land for the same purpose. And the farmers who say, I'm going to leave the land as good as I found it or better, that's the biblical understanding of the use of the land. The nurturing of the earth. Caretaking of the earth, both soil and water, so that the earth may continue to sustain life long after a particular farmer is gone. Another presupposition in the book is revealed in the title, that it is not their own land that farmers farm, but the Lord's land. It is, in an ultimate sense at least, not owned by the one who has title to it. The owner is God, and the steward or caretaker or manager of the land is the one who, in a human sense, may have title to the land for a time. The book has three parts: U.S. farming and food for people. And in that section, which I wrote, we have two chapters, one on the world food situation and how U.S. farming is a part of that. And we try to look at some of the fallacies that are abroad that you hear repeated regularly, such as the U.S. is the breadbasket of the world. Well, that's really not true in any meaningful sense. Most of the world's people eat the food that they grow themselves or that is produced within a mile of where they live. That's still true. I think the reason it is said that the U.S. is the breadbasket of the world is that we are very important in the international trade in cereal grains. In cereal grains, wheat, rice, barley, rye, corn, or maize, we are responsible for roughly one half of all the grain that moves in international trade comes from the United States. But that is not the same as saying that we're the breadbasket of the world, if by that we mean that we feed a large portion of the world. Most of the world's people still feed themselves, or they don't eat.
Then explain that again. Half of
the cereal grains that move in international trade originate here in the United States. But most of the people eat domestically grown food that doesn't go from country to country. That's the distinction that I'm drawing. So in the first chapter, we talk about the relationship of U.S. Farming, including exports and imports, to the world food situation. Part of that is, and this is often a fallacy too, we not only export a lot of food for the rest of the world, we import a lot of food from the rest of the world. So we depend, in fact, most of what we export goes to other high-income or middle-income countries. Most of what we import comes from low-income countries. Because of the nature of the imports, that's where they originate. They come from the poor of the earth, in the sense that it's the land of the poor that feeds us certain things that we can't produce ourselves. I want to come back to that a little later. Another chapter in that first part deals with food programs in the United States. And the interesting thing there, to me and to many farmers, although it's also irritating to many of them, is that the same legislation which includes the federal farm programs includes food stamps and other public assistance programs child nutrition programs, school lunch programs, elderly feeding programs. The omnibus farm legislation in recent years has included not only programs for farmers, commodity price supports, et cetera, but also the public food programs for the poor. And farmers, as a generalization, I could say, farmers don't appreciate that too much. They don't like to be included in the same bill with the recipients of food stamps, but they are. I happen to think that that's not a bad idea, because there's a political trade-off going on. The farmers' representatives in Congress are fewer all the time, fewer and fewer, as the farm population declines. The number of people who can be depended on in Congress to vote the interests of farmers, economic interests of farmers, declines. Increasingly, it seems to many, to get farm legislation through that gives farmers a fair deal, there have to be votes from people who represent other constituencies. And that includes the recipients of public food programs. And there's a kind of unholy alliance or strange bedfellows coming about that puts together those who represent public food program recipients with farm constituencies. And they increasingly have been having to work together to get legislation through. Well, there is a description in the book of what those public food programs are, how much they cost us each year, and some discussion of whether that's the best way or not to provide for the needs of hungry people in the United States. It is currently the most effective way. Whether in the long run it's what we should be doing is another question, but for the time being that's... I think we spend $10 or $12 billion a year on public food programs of various kinds. It's part of the welfare system. It's become an important part. Food stamps alone amounting to about $8 billion a year. But we also point out in the book that that $8 billion a year is 3 weeks' worth of military spending by this country. That sustains our military establishment for 3 weeks, the annual expenditure for food stamps. It would buy us less than five I think it's Polaris submarines. The second part of the book deals with the structure of U.S. agriculture, and the basic issue there is, can family farming as we have known it survive as the basic structure for most of American agriculture? So there are chapters that talk about the value of family farming, why it is worth preserving, its problems, and its prospects for survival. People always ask, what is a family farm? Well, we use a definition throughout the book, which I'll read to you. It's hard to define because what goes under family farming has great variety. The definition tries to anticipate that. A family farm is an agricultural production unit in which the management, economic risk, and most of the labor, peak seasons excepted, are provided by a given family, and from which that family receives the bulk of its income. Family farms can range from a 1 acre tobacco allotment in North Carolina, I guess you can make a living for a family from 1 acre of tobacco in North Carolina, to a Kansas wheat spread of several thousand acres. Both are family farms. The family farm is defined not in terms of acreage, but of independent entrepreneurship. The third part of the book deals with the manner of U.S. farming. Second part is the structure. Third part is the style or manner. And that includes such things as land and water management. How well are we doing? We're not doing very well. Some studies have said, for example, that half of the topsoil in the state of Iowa, the agricultural topsoil, has been used up in 120 years of farming. Since the plow was first turned to the prairie in Iowa, roughly half of the topsoil has been used. Well, it's used up not by growing things from it, but by practices which lead to its erosion, either by wind or water. It's not there anymore. It's washed down the Mississippi, or it's blown over into Kentucky or wherever it blows. Through wind and water erosion, and the conclusion is that with different practices, or with a return to older practices in agriculture, like crop rotation, contour plowing, those and windbreaks, many of which have been abandoned in the last 30 years in the name of all-out production, and monocropping, or planting the same thing year after year on the same land, that with a return to older and better forms of farming, we could arrest that erosion. And we can't afford another 120 years of what we've had, or there won't be any topsoil left in a state like Iowa.
It's not realistic, though, to really say that if we use those methods, we will stop.
There will still be some.
Yeah.
It may slow it. It may slow it. The point is, we are not regenerating the soil fast enough. We are taking the soil, we are using up the soil for a variety of reasons faster than we're not retaining it. I mean, we're just using it up. And how long you can continue to do that? The interesting thing to me is that some parts of the world, like China, have been farmed for 3,000 and 4,000 years, and the soil is still being reclaimed and retained because of the methods they use. See, we wash a lot of organic matter down the rivers, down our sewers and then down the rivers. The Chinese don't do that. They keep it all and put it back on the land, including human waste. So,
sure.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one I've read too. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Chemical fertilizer. Yeah. That's another issue in the manner of U.S. farming. One is land and water management. Another is energy and agriculture. There's increasing concern, as there is with energy in all aspects of our society, about the costliness of the way we farm, the energy costliness. As long as energy was cheap, petroleum energy, we didn't worry too much about how much energy it took to produce a bushel of corn. But when petroleum gets higher priced and less abundant, you start to ask, is it efficient? Efficiency in agriculture can be measured in many ways. We have normally, in the United States, like to talk about efficiency in terms of production per worker. And in terms of production per worker, we're the leading country in the world in agricultural efficiency. Do you know currently what one farm worker produces, how much food one farm worker produces, or how many people one farm worker produces for? It's been increasing for the last century. It's currently about 75. One worker produces enough food for 75 people. Where we are not efficient is if you measure agriculture in terms of input of energy for output of food energy. We're very inefficient. We use a lot of energy to produce food. The whole food system, in fact, and we'll come back to that, but the whole food system in the United States is very inefficient, as most things are, as in terms of energy units per unit of food. Most of the energy in U.S. agriculture is not used in producing food. It's used after it leaves the farm gate, in transporting it or processing it or even refrigerating the supermarkets where we buy it. And I don't mean just the frozen food section. I mean the refrigeration of our own bodies when we go into the supermarkets. And someone has observed that the most inefficient use of energy in all of American society is to drive a 2-ton automobile with one body in it to the grocery store to buy 20 pounds of groceries and haul them back home again, probably in air-conditioned comfort. That's the most inefficient use of energy because you don't need that much consumption of energy to get those groceries home. So energy in agriculture is another issue, including the possibilities in producing energy from agriculture, which is something we're beginning to look at. Gasohol, which is an alcohol mixed with gasoline, alcohol made from grain product, and other organic waste materials with methane conversion. Is Holden talking, Mary, about doing some production of methane?
Well, they're using wood chips and hydroelectric power to make whatever kind of fuel that makes. Is that methane?
Methane, probably. Oh. Yeah.
Well,
corn stalks and all of that can be used to produce methane.
What is used? What grain is used to make fuel? I mean, is it?
Currently, it's corn.
I mean, is it corn, edible corn, or is it what's left?
Well, I'm not an expert on it. According to what I've read, it does not use the nutrient of the corn. The nutrient of the corn is still available for human consumption. You can use the nutrient to produce gasohol, but you don't have to. Yeah?
Well, it can use either. And the byproduct is still good feed, high in protein.
For
so
cattle.
It's not wasted.
Right. That's my understanding.
The fact is, it's better feed after than before.
So what do they think? How do they do it? I mean, what, is it the stalk of
fermented.
The ear?
It's fermented.
No, it's the kernel. And I'm concerned, you know, talking about the stalk as being refuge, and yet that's the one part of the organic matter that is still left.
For the land.
For the land,
yeah.
Yeah, right.
You have to decide. If you're going to use it for fuel, it's not available for some other things, at least not all of it. So there are always those trade-offs. But I'm told that gasohol can be produced without destroying the nutritive value of the grain. Another controversy, which has a chapter devoted to it, is chemicals in agriculture, the use of chemicals. It's written by a Wisconsin farmer, a Lutheran, who happens to believe that we've gone far too far in using chemicals, putting chemicals on the land. And he thinks we have to pull back from that. He doesn't argue that we should eliminate all use of chemicals. We use chemicals for killing bugs, for killing weeds, or vegetable matter we don't want with the crop, and for fertilizer. As well as, and that's all petroleum-based, basically, as well as petroleum for energy in agriculture.
An issue, I don't know, maybe that you'll talk about or that you raise in the book on chemicals is for those of us looking on, it's easy to say, let's do away with the chemicals. And yet those who have turned to organic farming say that you can't, your first year is a disaster year. The next year, you might begin to be able to make a little bit. And it takes like up to 5 years to get your land converted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I think an issue that for this group, as maybe non-farmers, is if we are for non-chemicals, how are we going to support the farmer in this conversion?
Not only that, but most organic farming, at least in the short run, studies indicate it produces less. The farmer comes out the same because the input costs are less. The farmer doesn't have to spend all that money on expensive chemicals. But the total yield is also less. The net income may be the same or even better in some cases. So there's that issue as well. At least in the short run, you probably don't get the same yield. The other thing is, if you look at it globally, it's pretty clear that the increased use of chemicals in agriculture, including chemical fertilizer, ought to be in the developing world, not in the developed world. We should at least plateau and perhaps decrease our use per acre of chemicals. Parts of the world that are not using any chemicals, or very little, probably need to increase because the additional purchase, the additional yield you'd get from putting another unit of chemicals on the land would be greater in those areas than it would here.
Isn't the nitrogen that they put on in the soil taken out of the air and water?
Hydrogen.
Well, it's ammonia, which is hydrogen and nitrogen. And the nitrogen comes out of the air and the hydrogen comes out of water. So I don't know how much energy it requires to make the combination.
I don't know. I don't know that much about the chemicals that are in the fertilizer we use. I know that some of our fertilizer is petroleum-based.
My relatives in Nebraska all use ammonia.
Mm-hmm.
And I see that all across the Midwest, big ammonia tanks. And that comes out of the air and water.
There is also, I know, there are crops which fix the hydrogen in the soil that are part of the theory behind crop rotation is that you plant 2 years of crops that take out of the soil and then 1 year of legume crop that puts back hydrogen in the soil.
Okay.
Nitrogen fixing in the soil.
Charles?
Yeah.
But I've read statistically that small farms, if we could keep small family farms, would produce more food in the long run than agribusiness. And a small farmer, according to Wendell Berry, like in Unsettling of America, can take the time and has the cattle or the horses or whatever to take the manure and to put it on his land so he doesn't require as much chemical kinds of things. So it seems to me part of the problem is to try to keep small farms in existence, both for labor-intensive purposes and providing employment for more people and using less chemical fertilizers. I mean, I hate to just say, yeah, we have to continue using chemical fertilizers to the extent that we have. Well, you're not saying that.
No, I don't think we should.
There are ways of doing farming, according to some people, where we really don't need the kind of chemicals that we now put on huge spreads where agribusiness owns it.
Let's stop and look at what's been happening, Mary. Since I was, as a kid, working on farms in the summertime in Iowa, almost all the farms then in Iowa were diversified farms. That is, they had crops and livestock. And the manure from the livestock went back on the land. And there was rotation of the crops too. You didn't plant everything in corn or soybeans. You had one of the legume crops, alfalfa, I guess is one. You had rotation that every third, usually a three, clover is it? You had a 3-year rotation usually, as I remember it. And then the livestock, chickens, cows would produce dairy products and eggs and meat for the family. Well, in about 30 years, that's pretty well changed in the state of Iowa. Not totally, but a lot of farms that once were diversified are now single crop farms. Some of them are corn or corn and soybeans. Some of them are pig farms where they raise the corn for the pigs. But there's less diversification. One reason for that, I think, I've been told by some farmers, is they didn't like being tied down all year round to having to care for livestock. So unless they really wanted to raise livestock for its own sake, many of them got out of that. Many dairy people have gotten out of dairying for the same reason, because it keeps you close to home. And Barry is right. The smaller farmer who does farm that way is more likely to put in the hours and to be there whenever needed. There's a book out now that attacks the corporation in agriculture and says, who will sit up with the corporate sow? When the sow is going to have babies, who from the corporation is going to sit up at night with the sow? Well, that illustrates, I think, the point. That kind of farming had more drudgery in it and more being tied down to it than most of us in this room appreciate in our work. So I believe it's true, as Barry says, that the smaller family farmer is more likely to farm intelligently, take good care of the land, need less chemicals, but it's also a lifestyle that for many Americans we've tried to get away from.
There's another factor too in Iowa for the reduction of the farming of livestock versus where we're at. We're in north central Iowa, where the land is very flat and extremely expensive. And farmers cannot afford, they can maybe afford to have confinement hogs on the place where their buildings are. That even is questionable at times, but they cannot afford to have cattle because cattle take up too much land for pasture, etc. And the land has to be put into crops because that's your best way to make money.
Are you talking about expenses as property tax now?
No, I'm talking about how much you pay per acre for that piece of land.
However, if a family had been there for some time, they would not be.
If they've already got the land paid for, it may be different.
All right, but if you already, the thing is in our community is that if your family has already been there and you can afford, you already have the land, you're buying other pieces of property and you're one of the big farmers. If you are a person who is concerned about the small family farm and you want to get started and you may want to diversify farming even, the hardest thing is to even find a piece of land to buy, and the second is to be able to pay for it once you get your hands on it.
I meant to ask at the outset, how many of you are currently engaged in farming? Any? One or two. How many of you come from farm backgrounds, grew up on farms, or worked on farms as young people, or lived in farming communities? The majority of us. Okay, that's true of any cross-section of Americans today. You don't have to go too far back into our history, really earlier in this century, in fact, when a majority of Americans were still engaged in agriculture. What is it today? Do you know the percentage of our population today engaged in agriculture?
3%.
It's about 3.5%, somewhere between 3 and 4. And still declining. Yes?
This was 15 years ago, I was in Kansas in 1966 in my father's hometown, Hazleton, which is on the Oklahoma border, and it's a wheat community, wheat and cattle, and had declined from 4,000 somewhat at the time he graduated from high school in 1928 to 400 people in 1966, Christmas of 1966, because there was no work for people who had worked there previously, as the mechanization increased, only one child could stay on the ranch, and everybody else left, and it's just those towns are just dying because of the change in agricultural.
That's one reason why I believe the issue of family farm survival is a concern for the whole society, entirely apart from whether we get food on our tables or not. It's an issue of the fabric of the American settlement. Do we want everybody living in urban areas? Do we want people still on the land? I think we do, for a variety of reasons, which we can perhaps get into a little later. But it seems to me the church in particular has a self-interest, as well as a general societal interest, in supporting policies which will assure the survival of people on the land. And family farming is one way of doing that. At least slow down the decrease in elimination of farm operations. We had 6.9 million farm operations, many of them are very tiny, in the 1930s. Today we have one-third. We have 2.3 million. And the prediction is by the end of this century, it'll be down to about 1.6, with present trends continuing. And even if we change some of our policies, which have supported concentration, public policies, tax policies, commodity price support policies, and so on, which have supported increased concentration, even if we change some of those laws, we'll still be down around 2 million farms by the end of the century. I wanted to go back and pick up some of the questions of the book that I thought you might want to discuss here, too. One of them in the first chapter, where we talk about both exports and imports of food. Incidentally, in 1979, fiscal 79, we exported $32 billion worth of agricultural product. That's a little over one-sixth of all of our export, total value of export from the U.S. We imported that year close to $20 billion worth of food. So there's still a net margin for export of agricultural product. That helps to pay for some of the oil, where we have a net minus. But we did import $20 billion worth of agricultural product. Now, my question to you is, what makes that up? What makes up that $20 billion? What is it that you and I consume regularly that we import?
Coffee.
Coffee, of course. All the
chocolate.
Coffee.
Chocolate.
Hmm? Chocolate, all the chocolate.
Sugar.
Some of the sugar. We also have domestic sugar, but we import quite a bit of sugar.
Tea.
Spices. Keep going. Think of fruits.
Bananas.
Pineapple. Some liquor. I suppose that counts as agricultural product. It's made from grain and wines. Yes, yes. Why do we import beef?
Cheaper.
How do we use the imported beef, do you know?
Fast food.
That's right. Most of the beef now at McDonald's and similar places comes from Central America. And it's grass-fed, not grain-fed, and in hamburgers it doesn't matter that much. And so it's cheaper to import grass-fed beef from Central America than to buy domestic.
Along this line, talking about imports, I've read an estimate that within the next 10 years, we are going to have a crisis within our food industry, similar to the energy crisis that we had in 1974. Do you perceive any of that?
Well, say a little more. A crisis of what kind?
This person says that because our food production is so centered and dependent on massive transportation so far from our locales that we're going to have a major crisis. And just one example that this person didn't raise, but I then saw talking to a local grocer, was peaches in Iowa. We used to get them from the East Coast, but now there are so many people in the East Coast that we don't get peaches from the East Coast, so we used to get the lovely Colorado Alberta peaches, which many of us love to can and everything. But now we hardly get any peaches from Colorado because the population is growing there. And so we have to import all of our peaches from California. And so we have only one source of peaches for the Midwest.
The population's not growing in California.
this is just being as one example of, you know, if something should happen to, say, California peaches,
And if this started happening with...
We've also become spoiled into wanting to have everything all year round.
Mm-hmm.
And refrigeration with cheap energy and transport with cheap energy has made that possible. But you're absolutely right. That kind of crisis, that kind of change at least, in how centralized or decentralized the food system is, I think must come in the future. It probably isn't going to be possible in the 21st century to have all the fresh fruits and vegetables from California on the shelf and table in Boston that we've become used to. Yes?
But wouldn't that be one of the first things you could eliminate without being any crisis?
Well, I think so, if we can adjust to having a January without fresh tomatoes.
Well, 40% of winter vegetables in the United States come from Mexico.
That's right, that's the other part of it.
Starvation is a fact of life, and carnations for our ushers on Sunday morning.
Yeah.
That kind of thing is ridiculous. Well, if we'd all think we could make a tossed salad or use cabbage slaw, which can be kept in a root cellar or something, instead of having to have fresh tomatoes in January.
We used to have all these Waldorf salads in winter. Apples.
I think we can adjust. The question is, with what kind of grace will we adjust? And will we fuss about that like spoiled children?
Well,
I think there are adjustments coming. And it's,
well, but is the possibility even there? For instance, in Iowa, we have very few orchards anymore. They've been let go and plowed under and planted into corn because we get all of our apples from out here at Washington or other apple growing mm-hmm. places. And so in, say, the next 5 or 10 years, when we know where are we going to get our apples? We've got all your corn and your soybeans, but, we need some apples for our table.
There used to be near all large cities throughout the country, wherever growing conditions permitted, truck farms that raise fruits and vegetables for the populations in the cities there. A lot of those have been eliminated. I think we can go back to that. It may not be, when fuel is cheap, it may not be the most efficient way to use the land in terms of return. But when fuel gets expensive, it will again be efficient to use the land that way. And I think that'll have to happen. Or we'll have to learn to do without certain things. But as Mary says, we've not only moved from a very localized food system where people in this country also 100 years ago basically ate what they produced or what was produced near their farms, near their houses. We moved to a regional and then a national food system and now an international, so that the whole world really has become our oyster. We have food on our tables from all over the world. We expect it to be that way, and I think it may be, as history is unfolding, that will have been one century out of human history where that was possible. And then we'll go back to the way it used to be and decentralize the food system again. I think that is inevitable.
We took a big step backward during World War II when we shipped all the Japanese from the West Coast into Idaho. The Japanese were the ones who were doing the heavy bending work for truck gardens. And mm-hmm. our truck gardens are now swamps or have been used by industry.
In California, you mean?
In Washington.
Oh, in Washington. Yeah. Of course, in California, most of that labor now is Mexican-Americans or Mexicans. Incidentally, those of you who are from the Seattle area or from this part of the country may know about it. One of the arguments that was used in the last year, which led to the passing of a program to retain farmland in urban King County.
Yeah.
You know about that program? You're taxing yourselves. You voted in a referendum to tax yourselves to do that. Some say that's not the best way to do it, but that's the way you're doing it. To buy the development rights, the non-farm development rights from the farmer, so the farmer can stay in business as a farmer. One of the arguments that was used to get that through, I'm told, was precisely the one that we're on, Nancy, that Seattle in the future, if it's going to have fresh fruit and vegetable nearby, has to keep land nearby to do it, because it may become too expensive to ship it in. So that's an interesting little local working out of this problem. And I think there are communities on Long Island who come to the same conclusion, that to keep all of Long Island from going urban, they have to buy up the development rights from the farmers that are still there, and they've done that. They were the first to do it. Yeah.
One of the things that came to mind when we were talking about this, attempts to maintain a more diversified base for the food production, and also recognizing that the transportation and storage costs raise the cost of things like peaches and apples. there's another aspect that has to be considered in that also, and that is that if you do try to get away from this long-term storage and long-term shipping, we have to recognize that the basic process of producing those fruits and vegetables has changed to accommodate transportation. Washington State is a classic example. Washington State basically produces the double red delicious apple because it stores well and it ships well. It's very tough skin.
Yeah.
It's the only, from in Michigan, it's the only apple you ever see from Washington State. Same thing in terms of peaches. The what was the kind of peach you were talking about?
Alberta.
Yeah. You don't see the Alberta peaches around the East Coast too much because they don't ship very well. Red Havens and Hales are better peaches. They ship better. Well, if you're going to get away from storing the peaches and apples and things like that for a long period of time, you have to recognize that two-thirds of Washington's apple crop is going to go to waste because they're producing a bumper crop, planning to store it and sell it out for the whole rest of the year. People are just not going to buy 12 months of apples in 1 month.
We've done similar things with tomatoes. Developed a variety of tomato. It doesn't taste as good, but it's better for the automatic picker and the packer. It's a squared off tomato. And you know, I think if we want to, if consumer pressure requires it, we can go back again to what we did have before. That will mean though some
apple trees and peach trees maybe
because of the number of years involved. Another fallacy that's abroad with some of us, although I think many of us have learned a little more sophistication in this area, is the assumption that when prices go up at the supermarket, the farmer is getting more. Now, I want to say a little bit about that because the statistics are interesting. Overall, in the latest year for which figures were available, that was fiscal 79, the U.S. farmer received... What percentage would you guess of the final retail value of food? I mean, just food. No, it's more than that. Depends on the item. If it's a loaf of bread, it's like 3 or 4%. That's what the farmer got for the week. But overall, it's quite a bit higher. It's about one-third, about $1.03. It ranges all the way from 70% of the retail dollar with some meats, where nothing much is done to them. They're just cut up and sold, down to very little, as with wheat in the loaf of bread. There have been years recently when food prices overall went up and farm prices went down. And that's been the general trend the last decade, the last half decade. Why is that? And where is the rest of the dollar going? Where is the other two-thirds of the food dollar going? All of those. It's transporting, processing, advertising, packaging. Some have studied the cereal breakfast food industry and claim that there's more money in the cost of the box and the advertising than there is in the cereal.
Huh? Totally untrue.
It's not true?
As a packaging engineer for 6 years.
Okay, whatever is true, it is true that there is some money going into packaging of food.
Yes.
And that we pay for that when we buy our food. Processing, we're all of us eating more and more semi-prepared food when we buy it. It's already partially prepared. More of it is partially prepared than used to be the case. If that's what we want, fine. But we should be aware of what's happening and not blame the farmer for the increase in food prices necessarily. In fact, usually in recent years, it has not been the fault of farm prices. What else? Let's talk a little bit about energy use in the food system. I find this fascinating. 1/6 of all U.S. energy consumption annually is in the food system. That's production. It's 16.7%, almost exactly 1/6. Production, processing, marketing, preparation at home, preparation away, and transportation. The percentage of that goes into production, everything that is done with the food before it leaves the farmer's gate, including drying of grains, is 2.9% of the total U.S. consumption of energy, which is, what, about 1/6 of the 1/6 that goes into food. Processing is 4.8%. So processing is almost double what goes into production. Marketing, 1.3%. Transportation, 0.4%. So transportation, at least in this year, was not yet a very big item. Preparation at home,
4.5%. Preparation of food away from home, 2.8%. That's restaurant, fast food, all that. Energy efficiency people will tell you that it's more efficient to prepare food away from home than at home. That is, for the same amount of food served, you get more efficiency out of away from home preparation. So maybe if we want to be energy conscious, we should do more eating out. Or more eating in large groups a la Holden. I guess the institutional use of energy would be a big part of that too.
A good housewife will do two or three things in her oven to bake bread. At the same time, she'll dry some food. She might make a pie or something. My wife never heats her oven unless she can do two or three things with that heat. Same is true with on top of the stove.
At the same heat.
I'm still thinking a little bit about the packaging aspects of fast food and things like that. There is a big energy cost that's not being included there. If you make hamburgers at home, you don't wrap them up in paper and put them in a foam polystyrene box like you do at McDonald's.
Well, that may be included. I just don't know if that's counted. But that does seem to me to be a waste of... all of the use of styrofoam in fast food industry seems very wasteful because that's a one-time use.
There's a lot of petroleum-based waxes, and there's a lot of specially processed papers, all white paper in those cups. Not only does it take a lot more energy to make that, it takes particular kinds of materials, and it also makes an awful lot of pollution, that solid sulfate paper, and that's what makes that stinky stuff if you've ever been around a paper mill. It's the sulfate paper, and that's the kinds of things that are used in
And the plastic throwaway stuff is not biodegradable. It takes a long time to get that broken down again.
Bread for the World has a statistic out that it takes 20 times more energy to produce a bag of potato chips than to bake that potato in an oven for an hour. So somehow the processing and the packaging is...
Yeah. It's not real hard to make French fries at home. I mean, you can even say it's the same oil.
But the thing is that to do all of that at home really calls into question our whole lifestyle, and what we have said is the American dream. If I am a working woman, a career woman who is spending the same amount of time at my career that my husband is doing, and I have children to watch after and take care of when I get home, how am I going to find time to bake the bread, make French fries, make the stew? I think that it really calls into question where we're at.
You make half of it and he make half of it.
But still, at the same time.
It works in our house.
We have trouble making it work in our house. Because we have children.
Yeah, but Eartha, neither of us spends very much time in food preparation.
No.
We do quick meals.
Yeah.
We just don't shower the love and attention on food preparation that my mother did.
5 or 6 years.
We all do that.
All my
meals. For her, it was a full-time occupation.